All right, topic for today is this war that no one knows about, the war of attrition. Now, here's this idea. Right after the Six-Day War is over, you know, like weeks later, Egypt starts shelling again over the Suez Canal, positions that Israeli soldiers were over the Suez Canal. Why? Very smart move by Nasser. First of all, he regains prestige. They just got wiped out. And he says, I was knocked down, but I'm not out. Also, he solidifies himself as the head of, in the Arab world, saying, I haven't given up the struggle against Israel. I'm continuing to fight. He also knows that the Israeli Air Force is not going to get involved because that would escalate to a war. And there's no way they're going to go to a war again. So he feels, and this makes a lot of sense, that I can have this prolonged war of attrition because I don't really care how many soldiers we lose. We're a humongous country. And therefore, we can lose thousands and thousands of soldiers. But if Israel loses hundreds of soldiers, they'll go crazy. Right? And therefore, he has this prolonged war of attrition. So one of the major things that he does is he... Egypt, October 21st, 1967, sinks the Israeli ship, the Eilat, okay, killing 47 soldiers, okay, Navy men. Now, the ship was patrolling off Port Said in international water. This was an act of war. Israel was doing nothing. That was illegal, and yet they blew it up. Israel responded as it usually does, by blowing up some artillery, oil refineries south of Sinai, but casualties continue to mount. At one point, Moshe Dayan gives an order to do something daring. Okay, and here's one crazy thing that Israel did. I'm going to tell you a bunch of crazy things that Israel did during this war of attrition. September 1969, Israeli armored force using Soviet tanks and APCs with Egyptian army markings crosses the Gulf of Suez, lands under air cover, and then in a 10-hour surprise operation, codenamed Reviv, wreaks havoc along the enemy coast, destroying strong points, radar installations, army camps, leaving hundreds of dead and wounded, and the force withdraws.
Is this an intricate? Am I going to like die?
No. Not from that. The force withdraws unscathed. On the Israeli side, the sole loss was one fighter pilot who had to eject over the Gulf and was not found. The raid caused an earthquake in Egypt. The army and the navy chiefs were dismissed. Nasser actually had a heart attack. Right? The tank came in and caused so much damage. But again, this just continued. The war of attrition continues on for till like basically 1970. Tell you another crazy thing that Israel did. Israel stole, you ready for this? A radar station.
What?
Yeah, Israel stole a radar station. There was a Soviet-built radar station that weighed 7 tons. And yeah, they stole it. So how did they do that? So they came in on 2 helicopters. These helicopters that they got from the United States, CH-53D helicopters. America had no idea what kind of lift capacity it had, but they stole what was called a P-12 radar station. They unhooked it into 2 parts, and each plane lifted half of the radar station. They brought it back to Israel, reassembled it, and then said to the United States, would you like to see what a Soviet radar station looks like? Oh, yeah, don't mind if we do. So they just stole, they lift, can you imagine come to work the next day and go, where's the radar station? We're talking about a 7-ton radar station. So there were lots of crazy things that were going on here. Like I said, over this 3-year period, Israel suffered a lot of casualties, close to 1,500 soldiers. Egypt were tens of thousands. But like I said, for the Israelis, this was difficult, and Egypt wouldn't discontinue. They kept going. One of the more famous, came later famous, raids was the Israeli assault on Green Island. This was done by Shayetet Shlosh Esrei, Israel's, you know, SEAL team, Navy SEALs. Now, this is what happened. Like I said, in the war of attrition, it was like a chess game. You do this, I counter with this. It goes back and forth, back and forth. So, 1969, July of 1969, Egyptian commandos make their way across the Suez Canal, and they attack an Israeli position at Netzach on the east bank, killing 7 Israeli soldiers and wounding 5 others, taking back to prisoners the 5 wounded. Okay, this killed Israel's morale. Who's manning these stations? People in Miluim, reservists who just want to finish their reserve duty, their Miluim, and get back to their families. And now everyone, every Israeli does Miluim. So everyone's thinking, like, that could be me. So Israel needs to respond. Can you open the window a little bit? Sorry, it's all hot for you? Okay. The IDF gives the Navy SEALs the job of figuring out a target and a response. Shayet the Shlosh Esrei. Okay? And says, you guys have to figure it out. Rafael Eitan is in charge of commando raids, gives them a week, and this is what they come up with. There is one place that Egypt Egypt felt was impregnable, okay, and that was Green Island. This was a place that was built by the British, a fortress on an island not so big. It was a man-made island about the size of a football field, but with lots of radar installations, and this was to control the seas, okay, control the area of the seas, see anyone that's coming and going. It was manned by 100 of Egypt's top commandos. Now, the easy thing to do is just to buy a plane and blow it up. Okay? But, like I said, here the idea was more like a chess game. You did a commando raid, we'll show you what a commando raid looks like. I remember reading, like, someone told me they just read the Mossad book. Elliot told me. There was this raid. Okay, the British Navy SEALs, I don't know what they're called. SAS is their, like, their elite units. The SEA is also called the SAS? Okay. So, I remember reading that, could be. They said to the upcoming class, we're going to study Israel's raid on Green Island. If we could do something half as good, we'll be the greatest commander unit in the world. Sort of. Doesn't make so much sense because obviously Israel's greater if they're only, but still, meaning like this is what they're going to study because it was amazing what they did. Okay? I guess maybe it meant if we can act like this at all times. I don't know. Anyway, the head of Shayetet Shlosh Esrei was a person named Shmuel Almog. He was so demanding that only 30 men made it into Shayetet Shlosh Esrei. He only took the best of the best. Okay? He felt this particular mission needed 40 men. Okay, again, we're taking on the elite Egyptian commandos of 100 who have the high ground, all the equipment, and we'll see how they have to do this. But for whatever reason, you know, 40 was sufficient. So they had to draft people from the Seret Matkal. Okay? Now, Seret Matkal, they aren't Navy SEALs. So they took 20 Navy SEALs who were going to come in underwater. And then, after the fighting begins, the Seret Matkal, who are anchored, they're anchored like, you know, 1,500 meters away, they'll come on speedboats to aid in the attack. Okay, we'll see that doesn't really happen according to plan, for whatever reason. I tried looking, I couldn't find why, but it took a long time until the Seret Matkal showed up. So the Navy SEALs had to take over all sorts of parts of the island that was sort of reserved for the Shayetet, you know, for the Seret Matkal, till they finally showed up. So we basically have 20 guys that are taking on 100. And okay, here's how it goes. Any ship that would be coming over water would be spotted. They have light towers. They have everything there. They have people manning this all the time, and they're expecting something might happen. So they're on high alert. Okay. So what do they decide to do? Shmuel Almog, he takes 20 of his soldiers. He doesn't want, what if they all get killed? So there's 10 that don't go on this mission. 20 of his Navy SEALs. they anchor their boats, their Zodiac, you know, speedboats, 1,500 meters away, and they now swim under the water to there. Now, it turns out, first of all, they decide to take AK-47 instead of the Israeli-made Uzis. There's a better chance that it would function after being submerged in the water so long. Okay?
But there's a chance that it could...
There was no such thing, though.
Really?
Yeah, no such thing. Now,
so there was a chance that,
that things were not going to work, and things did not work. Okay? They take off, and they're swimming. Turns out, the current was against them. It took longer. Plus, every single soldier is equipped with his personal weapon, ammunition reserves, grenades, first aid equipment, canteen, flashlight, flippers, oxygen tanks, mask, and life preserver. All in all, about 40 kilos or close to 90 pounds that he's swimming with underwater. It was so much equipment that it also was pushing them down lower. It was swimming lower than they had wanted just because they were so heavy. Okay. They get there later than they thought, about 15 meters from the island. You know, the flotilla leader, 6 or 7, he sees that there's guards there, goes back underwater, and they get to a certain place where they can get their diving gear off. Okay, now, they're finally on some sort of somewhat concealed place in the army. They get off their stuff, and they're ready, and they start cutting through a fence. One of the Egyptian sentries sees them, starts to shoot. They take him out. Another one starts coming, and all hell breaks loose. Most of their hand grenades do not work. So imagine, you're sitting there, okay, see, lob a grenade, nothing. Okay? The head of the SEAL team here, the Shehad, the Shalosh HaSrei, his radio doesn't work. So the Seir Matkal don't hear him. Right? So they don't come when they're supposed to be coming. And they're, like I said, taking over areas that reserve for the Seir Matkal. Now, when this was over, First Lieutenant Ami Ayalon, who would later go on to be involved in Israeli intelligence, he received the yellow ribbon.
People died?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
The yellow ribbon. I'll get to this. He received, yeah. He received the yellow ribbon. Only, how high an honor is it? Only 3 IDF soldiers, including Ami Ayalon, ever received this medal. All of them were from Shehad HaShalosh HaSrei. Now just listen to the official version of why he got the ribbon and tell me this guy is not Rambo, okay? On the night of July 19th, 20th, in the Battle for Green Island, First Lieutenant Ami Ayalon was deputy commander of a band of operators in the assault. At the time of the attack, he tossed a grenade at the radar position and during the assault moved ahead of his soldiers to lead the attack. When he climbed the roof from one position, he suffered shrapnel wounds to the forehead, but still managed to hurl a grenade, even though it failed to explode. Under heavy fire, continued his advance along with First Sergeant Zalman Ruff and wiped out a machine gun nest. He later hooked up with another operator and wiped out 2 more enemy positions. Leading the attack against the gun position, a grenade blast seriously wounded him, though he continued to fire his weapon at enemy positions. Another enemy grenade detonated near him, this time wounding him in the hand and neck. Severely wounded and bleeding profusely, he managed to continue his attack. And only after the mission was complete did he inform his superiors of his wounds and evacuate himself. Who does that? I don't know. It's like crazy. One of the people that went on this had been a former POW in Egyptian hands. According to international law, you're not allowed to go back to fighting. And if you are, there is absolutely no rules how they can treat you. They can do whatever they want to you. They violated the terms. Okay, and he's there. This Ilan Egozi, another person who was decorated fighting. Now, they go door to door, very stiff resistance coming, and they start taking them out slowly, slowly. Finally, Egypt starts realizing something's going on, and they realize Israeli commandos must be on the island. Start shelling the island, right? They're shooting missiles at Green Island. At this point, you know, the Israelis figure it's time to get off the island. As their accuracy starts getting closer and closer to the island. It's a difficult journey back. They end up getting out. In the end, Israeli commandos wipe out 80 out of the 100 Egyptian soldiers, nearly everyone there, and it put the Egyptian military on notice. All in all, I think 6 soldiers were killed. Right, 6 soldiers were killed, and 14 wounded. But they...
That's everyone.
Well, it's out of 40 if you count those people from Saramakala also count. Okay.
It's pretty crazy.
Crazy. Now, another crazy thing. You mentioned before... Yeah. Huh?
If Israel knows they have 100 guys,
why they send... I don't know. They don't have that many people that are even capable. So they do the best they can.
Something capable, like some guys are capable, like more guys are in the hall. I don't know.
I don't know. Now, we mentioned that in the early part of the stay, very hard to get weapons. Any of you guys ever visit the bullet factory, like one of the kibbutz?
The
whole thing. Went here with the yeshiva just recently. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've been this many times. I don't remember what year goes to one, goes to the next. And you know the laundry thing above it. Like they had all these cockamamie schemes. They was putting rifles and steamboats and all sorts of ways to try to get money. We spoke about weapons. We spoke about how Czechoslovakia helped us. One of the countries that was a big arms supply for us was France. And we had a good relationship with them. 56, we helped them in, you know, gaining passage back through the Suez Canal after, you know, Egypt decided to close it. We spoke about the Sinai campaign. More than that, Algeria was starting this rebellion against France. And Israel's intelligence community helped give France necessary information to help put down this rebellion. So we had tanks that were coming, Mr. A planes that were promised over the next 10 years, supposed to be 200 tanks, 100 planes. But 1967, de Gaulle, prime minister, says, that's it. If you guys are going to fight in the Six-Day War, not knowing it's going to be a Six-Day War, obviously, so then you're cut off. And Israel fights, as we know. Okay, at this point, the United States is not an armed supply for Israel. Had they been, who knows what would have happened. When Lyndon Baines Johnson told Israel not to go it alone, not to go to fight against them, had they been the primary arms supplier, could be Israel never would have gone through with the Six-Day War. But since they weren't, Israel didn't have a hard time telling the United States to take a hike. De Gaulle is upset and he cancels the shipment that's already been paid for of Israeli merchandise of weapons. Okay, his successor George Pompidou continues, and now here it is: Israel ordered 5 boats. Okay, 5 particular boats, gunboats that were. Now embargoed in France, the port of Cherbourg, and it was, they felt it necessary. The sinking of the Eilat showed the need for these Cherbourg boats, smaller, better maneuverability, and we see, in the end, it will play a decisive role in Israel's victory in 1973 in the Yom Kippur War. As I said, France held it up and decided that they were not going to deliver it. So what did Israel do? They stole the boats. And they steal the boats. So they go to Cherbourg and they disguised, Mossad agents disguised as Norwegian naval officers, sail the boats out of France. Okay? They had all this paperwork, said they were buying the boats. It was Christmas Eve when basically everyone in France was smashed at some, all the workers at the port were partying through the night. And the lonely, shomrim, the lonely guards that drew the short straws and had to be there that night. So Mossad gave them a nice bottle of champagne, and they looked the other way as they sailed 5 boats right out of the port on their way to Israel. They did a very risky thing. In order to get there, there was no time to refuel anywhere, so they refueled while they were on the move. Right, which could rupture the fuel lines, but they did this, continue the boats, should be able to keep moving, get out of there as quickly as possible. Last hurdle was at Gibraltar. Okay?
Wait, did France go crazy at them?
Let's see. Gibraltar. They see the boats. Morse code. What ship? Identify. No answer. Repeat. What ship? Identify. No answer. One more time. Israel guessed, and they guessed correctly, that the British probably knew what was going on, who took from where, and the Brits never missed an opportunity to stick it to the French. They said, okay, fine, stick it to the French. Now, when the French defense minister heard what happened, he wanted to send the Air Force to blow them out of the water. The Prime Minister, Pompidou, was on vacation. He contacted him, and Pompidou overruled him. So Israel sailed the ships out of France. Fine. Now, 1969, Lady Eshkol passes away. Prime Minister, who was Prime Minister we spoke about during the Six-Day War, and he is succeeded by whom? Who succeeds him? Golda Meir.
Right.
Golda Meir, born in Kiev, Ukraine, but grown up, educated in Milwaukee, okay, becomes the second female prime minister in history. The first is some name that I can't pronounce from Sri Lanka. But Golda Meir, she's number two, takes over. When asked by reporters if women are better than men, she said, I cannot say, but I can say there's certainly no worse. Okay? And she takes over. She's a very tough woman, chain smoker. Very, very tough woman. Very fixed views, strong personality. When people talk about Palestinians, she said, who's Palestinian? Jordan is Palestine, right? That was her view. She said, I'm Palestinian. She showed a passport. She moved to Israel, called Palestine. She goes, who do they think they are?
She's very right wing.
Yeah, but what was then a left wing party, by today, she'd be considered a right wing. She kept trying to push Nasser to have peace, and Nasser would refuse. And she said, very interesting, listen to this statement. Alex, listening? I have given instructions that I be informed every time one of our soldiers is killed, even if it's in the middle of the night. When President Nasser leaves instructions that he be awake in the middle of the night, if an Egyptian soldier is killed, then there will be peace.
Say it again. I missed.
Right? If he cares about the loss of his soldiers the way I care, we'll find that peace. But he couldn't care less. Right? She said, the only thing I can't forgive Nasser for is forcing our boys to kill his boys. Right? But she was very tough.
She's good.
She, 1970, Russian piloted MiGs got involved. Not just Russian planes piloted by the Egyptians. Russian piloted MiGs were shooting at the Israeli Air Force.
Why?
And at first, because Russia's behind all of this, right? So, at first, Golda Meir says, we're not starting up with Russia. At one point, they said, enough is enough. And she gives permission for the Israeli Air Force to fight back. And on Friday, July 30th, given permission to engage, dogfight ensues with Israel downing all of the Russian MiGs to no Israeli losses. Both countries kept the secret for 25 years. Right? Took out the Russian things. Obviously, Russia doesn't want to say because it's embarrassing. And Israel's keeping their mouth shut because if Russia's embarrassed, it's not good for us.
Wait, so who said how many MiGs do they have up there?
25 years later, came out. I don't know. I don't have it written down here. I don't remember how many.
And we smoked it.
Yeah. Now, PLO now starts really becoming a force. Okay? Israel, during this war of attrition, weeds them out, basically kicks them out of the West Bank. By 1970, the war of attrition pretty much ends. Nasser calls off the dogs because Israel was just too, was attacking too hard. He finally stops it. Now they're going against the PLO in the West Bank, and they run away. Where do they go to? Jordan. What does Yasser Arafat do? He says, all right, let's go now and destabilize Jordan so that we can, 1970, we can take over Jordan. There are more Palestinians, there still are more Palestinians in Jordan than members of the Hashemite Kingdom. Basically, it's an apartheid, right? You have the Hashemite Kingdom ruling Jordan, but the majority of the civilians there are Palestinians. So he had, people on his side, and King Hussein puts it down with a vengeance. It's called Black September. September 1970, he just, forget about morality, forget about being nice, things that you say all the time we should do, he did it. He went and did it. Now Israel very interesting. How things, you know, you never see who's your enemy, who's your friend. Israel moves their tanks up to the border with Syria because Syria threatened to get involved and help the PLO. And Israel moves its tanks up to the border and tells Syria, stay out of it. Let them handle it. You get involved, we get involved. And Syria stays out of it. And it's for that reason that Jordan sort of from then on sort of became friendlier with Israel, because King Hussein owed something a little bit to Israel.
By not letting Syria get involved.
Why? By not letting Syria get involved.
And then what happens with all those people? Like, literally, like, they wiped the floor.
Now, during this time, the PLO, they start having, their big thing now is hijacking. And they start hijacking planes all over the country, all over the world, right? In September 1970, four planes were hijacked.
Operation Thunderbolt?
No, that's later. Four planes, TWA, Pan Am, BOAC, Swiss Air. Hijacking became the way that, you know, to, again, terrorism. One of the victims on one of the hijacked planes was Rav Yitzhak Kuttner. Rav Yitzhak Kuttner, who's Rashid of Chaim Berlin, was on his way from Israel back to New York, and he was he's one of the people that was hijacked. They were held in this place. Eventually, people were released, but this was going on. But hijackings all the time. There were lots of different hijackings. Okay, one of the famous rescues. Here's a picture. Sabina, 1974. Okay, this was hijacked, landed in Israel, and they demanded that Israel release hundreds of terrorists that were being held in Israeli prisons. So, Defense Minister Moshe Dayan conducts a lengthy negotiations with them, all the while signals to the Sayeret Matkal, "You got to save the day." Who's the head of Sayeret Matkal? At this point, Ehud Barak. Ehud Barak, this is an interesting thing. If you're a Sayeret Matkal, no one knows. Okay? They're not walking refrigerators. Right? Most of these guys, you look at the people like in the Special Forces in America, they all look like, you know, Mack trucks.
These guys like
Sayeret Matkal, they look like everyone else.
They just run. And it's also...
It's a lot of, as my son said to me once when I said, how do you keep beating these guys that are older than you? He goes, it's not about here, it's about here. Sayeret Matkal, it's here. Ehud Barak was known, there was no lock that he couldn't, you know, pick within 8 seconds. Everyone had different things. Bibi was considered like big for Sayeret Matkal. You know, he's big. But, you know, Sayeret Matkal...
It's always that, like Israeli, like, prime ministers before have, like, a...
In the military. Yeah, a lot. If you're in the military, it's like a stepping stone to politics. I remember watching this movie where Harrison Ford plays a president, and his plane is hijacked. I forgot right now what it is, and he like fights off the terrorists. Now he, what did he do? In Vietnam was like, I don't know, a pilot that took reconnaissance pictures. He wasn't like, but I was thinking like in Israel that could actually really happen. All of our private Ehud Barak. Sayeret Matkal, beating up Sayeret. Like, it could make sense that these guys could, yeah, I've killed people with my bare hands before, I can do it, you know. In this movie, the Harrison Ford's like, oh my God, what should I do, you know. But like, in Israel, like, yeah, you know, been there, done that, you know. So, what did Israel do? They said, okay, we're going to give in. And they sent all of these, they sent workers in their white coveralls to refuel the plane. And then they burst on, they got up on the window, they knocked through the floor, they came in, they killed all the terrorists and rescued all the people. There's a famous picture of Ehud Barak holding a pistol right outside the, you know, the plane, on the window of the plane. Bibi Netanyahu was involved in this. I have a neighbor, Micha Bloch. He was a sharpshooter, you know, from a distance. He wasn't on the plane, but he was like giving cover. Yeah. He's the first Frum guy to be in Matkal. He went for the interview, they said no. And he sat outside the Matkal office for 48 straight hours. And they said, all right, you're in. You know, that's the type of guy that we want. So, okay. Now I want to end. Let's talk about one last thing. Very, very sad thing, but a well-known thing. 1972. What happened in 1972? If you're Jewish, what am I talking about? What? Good. The Munich Massacre. Okay, so now, just you have to understand. In 1936, Germany held the Olympics. Okay, and it was a shame for them, and they were looking for 1972 to sort of rectify that. 36 was Adolf Hitler trying to show the world how amazing Germany was, and much to his chagrin, Jesse Owens wins 4 Olympic, you know, medals, setting 3 world records when against the Aryan race, you know. So that was a little pie in the face for Hitler. So machlokes if he actually saluted or didn't salute, you know, supposed to salute all the winners. Now it was 1972, generation later, and everyone wants to have a beautiful Olympics in Germany to show the world how Germany has changed. But it didn't. And what happened now was as follows. September 5th, at 4:30 a.m., 5 Arab terrorists wearing tracksuits climbed a 6.5-foot fence around the Olympic Village. And it was seen by lots of people, but no one thought anything about it. Because a lot of times these athletes went out drinking, and then they came back, and they, you know, snuck back in. And everyone thought that's it. They were in their tracks, their little gym bags. And okay. There was a few others. There were 3 more inside, altogether 8, that must have gotten in some other way. And now, at 4:30 in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, they knock on the door of where the Israeli athletes are sleeping. Israeli wrestling coach Moshe Weinberg opens it up, right away with something wrong. So he's yelling to everyone to get out of there. He and Yosef Romano try to hold the door in, gets bashed in. The people that were trying to escape, they get killed. And they succeed in rounding up 9 Israelis and they're held as hostage. 9:30 a.m., terrorists announce that they were Palestinians. They demanded Israel release 200 Arab prisoners. They threatened to kill the athletes unless the terrorists were given safe passage out of Germany. Israel offers Germany, we'll send Sert Nakal to help you guys deal with the terrorist situation. And Germany says, we got this. Okay, famous last words. Tense hours of negotiations. Turns out it's a PLO group, a faction known as Black September, named after the month when, you know, Jordan took out many of the members there. And a plan is agreed upon. They agreed to give them this helicopter to a NATO base in Fürstenfeldbruck. There, the hostages will be flown to Cairo. Okay? All fine and good. Germany's ready for this. They have sharpshooters set up. And when they're going to be making this exchange, they're going to take them out. Except they didn't realize, it's like to your question, that there were more terrorists than they thought. And they didn't have enough sharpshooters. And they said, oh, it'll only take out 2 or 3 of them so that all the athletes will get killed. So in the end, the whole thing gets messed up.
How many terrorists were there?
8.
Fighting breaks out. One of the helicopters was blown up by the terrorists. The remaining hostages in the second helicopter were shot to death by the surviving terrorists. Now, 1 month later, a German plane was hijacked, and hijackers demanded that the Germans release the 3 terrorists who had been captured in Munich, be released. And Germany didn't hesitate. I said, okay. So the terrorists were released. Israel and the West condemned them, but Germany couldn't care less. And that's why, as we know, that an Israeli assassination squad was sent to hunt down the Palestinian murderers and those responsible for planning the Olympic massacre. Movies were made about this. Spielberg made a movie about it. And 8 out of 11 were killed. Of the remaining 3, 1 died of natural causes, the other 2 assassinated, but it's not sure if it was done by Israeli agents or not. I want to end just with reading one thing. When I was in Israel, I came in 72. I came in the summer of 72, and they were all talking about this woman, Esther Roth, who was going to win an Olympic medal. Okay, Israel, at this point, they never won an Olympic medal. And she had won all these European track and field events, and she was Israel's best chance of winning a medal. Okay, here's her recollections of this day. As soon as I took my first stride on the track in 1967, my coach, Amitzur Shapiro, told me that he was preparing me for the Olympic Games. Here it was, September 1972, we went to the Munich Olympiad. The Israeli delegation included 22 athletes, as well as coaches, referees, and executives. The men were housed in one dormitory, and swimmer Shlomit Nir and I in another, some 200 meters away. We arrived in the Olympic Village, we were given final security instructions. especially told to beware of letter bombs, which were quote-unquote fashionable at the time. Then we were separated and mingled with athletes from all over the world. Observing the mixture of people there was a great experience. It was easy for us to guess the athletes' area of expertise by looking at their body structure. The tall ones, the basketball players, the short guys, the weightlifters, and those with swollen ears were the wrestlers. I was also enchanted by the colorful carnival costumes. At the same time, I was full of anticipation for the competitions. The festive Olympic atmosphere was suddenly shattered when we heard the terrible announcements that terrorists had entered the Israelis' dormitory, taking them hostage. On entering, they had killed Moni Weinberg, who tried to block the door with his body. They then killed Yosef Romano, who had fought them, although his leg was in a cast. The night before the attack in the Olympic Village, the Israeli delegation had been invited to see Fiddler on the Roof, starring Shmuel Rudensky, which had been a great success in Germany at the time. I sat next to Coach Ami Tzor, who spoke German and translated a text for me. We were the guests of honor, and we were in a wonderful mood. Our group lifted Rudensky and me up, and we had our picture taken like that. The next day, I celebrated reaching the finals of the 100-meter hurdles, having set a new record. That evening, my coach and I arranged to meet at the cafeteria the next morning. Shlomit Nir woke me up in the morning, telling me that terrorists had gotten into our friend's room. They must evacuate ours at once. We were terrified. We were taken somewhere else in the village, but those who escaped had gathered, and together we listened to reports about the negotiation between the terrorists and our government, headed by Golda Meir. Every hour or so, we heard a shot that made us even more edgy and uncertain. I'll never forget the moment I saw the 9 athletes, their hands tied behind their backs, taken away by the armed terrorists. There they made their way in a line towards 2 waiting helicopters, climbed in and took off, illuminated by dozens of camera flashes, never to return. Helicopters landed in a military airport in Munich, where German snipers awaited them. The Germans, however, failed in their attempt to release the Israelis. We returned to Israel with 11 coffins. And throughout this whole thing, the Olympics continued to go. Because that's what happens. One writer for the Los Angeles Times says, like having a dance at Dachau, the Olympics goes on. But this was this. I have 2 seconds. I'll tell you one cool story that Rabbi Ami Merzel once said several years ago. I don't know if he's repeated it for any of you guys or in his hood. He told a story about this American bike rider. And I went and looked it up. You heard the story? American bike rider who was doing great in these competitions, but he felt anti-Semitism. He won this event by a lot, but he put his hands up in the air like before he got to the finish line, and they disqualified him. He said, this is ridiculous, and he left. I went and looked, I found him in Sports Illustrated. I looked back, some old pictures. And he makes it to Israel, and he's biking, and he's traveling, he's in Yerushalayim, and he's picked up in the yeshiva, and he starts becoming from. But the same thing was back to Tel Aviv, where it's not as hilly. He's doing his biking. And he is now the head of the Israeli biking team. And Israel's now going to have their qualifying for the Olympics. And he's the best chance that Israel has to have a speed enough to be accepted in the Olympics. But Israeli Olympic decided they're going to have the competition on Shabbos. And this guy's sitting there waiting. Shabbos, should I, shouldn't I? Because I'm in front. He said, that's it. He doesn't go to the competition. Israel doesn't have a biking team. And that year was 1972. And he would have been one of the athletes right here. And he says, now getting chills, I know what I'm about to say. He says, my favorite song was Ki Eshmara Shabbat El Yishmarini. If you guard Shabbos, God will guard you. And he refused to be Machal Shabbos. Ki Eshmara Shabbat, El Yishmarini. He lived to tell the story.
Wow.